ached deeper than he had realized. Nearly 15 meters of flesh to hew through before his warriors broke clear, forming up once more on the far side of the charnel mound. Still the enemy did not give in, rushing at the imperial fists with hoarse yells and shrieked invocations to their dark masters. Volleys of bolter fire cut down scores of traitors at a time. The Huskarls battered with shield and slashed with blade, dismembering and decapitating any enemy that reached the line. Through the smog and gas, past the heaving mass of foes, Rand saw yellow plunging into the horde half a kilometre ahead from the left and right. As the armoured columns came around the defence spurs like ancient ships of the line rounding headlands into a harbour, flares of lasfire and muzzle-flash lit the sickly cloud, the strobing of multi-lasers flashing like red navigation lights. Caught between the tanks and the shield wall, the traitor horde finally slowed, unsure whether to press on against the infantry or turn to swamp this new threat with their numbers. The armoured columns linked up on the highway and turned inwards together, spaced so that they could shoot past each other, heading back towards the shield wall, weapons firing non-stop to both sides, turrets spewing lascannon blasts and autocannon rounds. The fusillade cut lines through the unarmoured enemy, their dead falling in waves like the spreading ripples of stones tossed into a pool.
"Huskarls! Gate formation!"
Rand bellowed when the lead vehicles were just 100 meters away, approaching fast. Like a double door opening, the shield line divided. Rand at the right-hand end of one gate, Sergeant Autor securing the other. They marched outwards, so that the line shifted but still faced directly towards the enemy. Rand could see mutants and traitors crushed against lowered dozer blades or speared by assault spikes as the column came on without slowing, punching through the horde like an armoured fist. They roared past the line, guns falling silent at the last moment, tank after tank grinding through the gap between the two gates of the shield wall. They split again, peeling to the left and the right to form a support line behind the infantry companies, taking up positions beside the dreadnoughts. There were barely a few hundred foes left to target, many of them running one way or another in terrified confusion, some huddling among their dead to hide from the Imperial Fist's wrath.
"Permission to seek and destroy, Commander!"
came the call from Lieutenant Lucid, leading the fast reserve.
"Granted. 10 minutes only, then withdraw to the port."
"Understood. First assault, withdraw by squads. Armour to provide cover fire, and then withdraw by squadron."
The last of the vehicles passed through the line, a Spartan assault tank that slewed around to come to a stop a few metres behind Ran, guns tracking back and forth over his head. The Lord Seneschal strode up to it and rested his shield against the side, using the sponson for handholds, much to the audible amusement of the gunner within. He hauled himself up to the roof. The tank commander was standing in one of the forward hatches, the grips of a pintle-mounted combi bolter in his hands. He slid the weapon aside and pulled himself up to join Ran, fist clashing on his chest in salute.
"Welcome aboard, Commander. That's quite a view, isn't it?"
The whine of anti-grav engines and scream of propulsor jets filled the air as 6 squadrons of land speeders swept overhead, just a few metres above the defensive line. Ran grinned as he watched them pass, a fist raised to salute them to victory.
"Good hunting!"
he called over the vox. The chatter of heavy bolters and hiss of missiles faded with distance as Lucid's fast reserve chased after targets of opportunity. Rand looked back to the Lionsgate spaceport, and then out along the highway. Multispectral filters flickered across his view, picking out the body heat of the cooling dead. It was as though the ground were carpeted with undulations of fading orange and dark red, as far as his enhanced senses could penetrate the smog banks. With the Emperor's children and world-eaters inbound, it was just the beginning. However, he thought, 300,000 enemy dead in 2 hours was not a bad morning's work. Arabindian Massif, 97 days before assault. As far as anyone could tell, the train was moving at a conservative 10 kilometres an hour, which surprised nobody, given its immense size and weight, even with two plasma reactors driving its motors. Its purpose was to convey large volumes of people, but it was certainly not doing so swiftly. Routine had been the cornerstone of life on the factory line, and it quickly became the bedrock of Zenobi's existence as a member of the Defence Corps. Each day was carefully scheduled and regulated, assigned duties moving through the platoons of the company as the roster and occasional punishment dictated. They drilled with their weapons, power packs removed, and turned spare mattresses into dummies for bayonet practice. The food was pretty much indistinguishable from day to day, but given that they had all lived in the downhive spurs for their whole lives, such culinary tedium was of no remark. The integrity officers were a constant, low-key presence. As warned, they started conducting interviews from the very first day. Names were called, and troopers were escorted up to the top deck. They returned either within minutes or after more than an hour. There never seemed to be any absence between these two extremes. They were loath to discuss what they had seen, but persistence pried a few details from hesitant lips. Though there was little enough to tell, lest they had all been taken up the central ladder and down a narrow passage to a bare interview room. They had glimpsed the gunnery rondels and other doorways, which they assumed were the quarters of the crew, but little else. A few of those that had been summoned had spied a little of the train's surroundings through open turret doors and the firing slots beyond. Even so, there was nothing in their reports to excite, for they all returned with descriptions of endless grey sky and, if they saw the ground, an undulating expanse of dried seabed. Of what occurred within the interview chamber, even less was said, other than that there was nothing to worry about if everybody told the truth. Zenobi had expected to be interviewed early, being part of the command squad of the platoon and the company's standard-bearer, but days passed without her name being called. She'd started keeping note of who had been, in an effort to predict when it would be her turn, but after 3 days she was forced to conclude that either she had no idea what the criteria were for the order of selection, or the troopers were being taken upstairs at random. About a week after leaving Jibu, the captain and lieutenants disappeared shortly after the midday inspection, ascending en masse to the mystery world of the upper deck. Like many others, Zenobi wanted to follow, to try to sneak a look at what delights and secrets were housed above. However, the dynastic enforcers were around in number, visible at the top of every ladder. It was not just Zenobi's company. Officers from the lower decks went past until it was clear that the whole carriage had been emptied of every rank above sergeant.
"I hear there are going to be some big news, Yeye," said Celine. "Everyone going to be told at the same time. No rumours, just one truth."
"No rumours," laughed Member.
"Then what are you saying? That's a rumour. You know what I mean, Fala," said Celine with a shake of her head.
"It's got to be Horus," said Ketai.
"Keep it down," hushed Member, glancing towards the closest ladder to the top deck.
"What?"
The trooper shrugged.
"Saying his name a crime now, is it?"
"It could be,"
growled Member.
"Nah, I been in with the integrity officers," said Celine. "Our platoon is good. We're all true to the cause and they know it. Volunteers, yeah? We were doing the recruiting. I don't care if you got a signed letter from the dynastic chiefs themselves," said Member. "I don't think those integrity officers need much to take offense. Even if the news is about Horus, it might not be bad news," said Zenobi.
"It could be anything," agreed Member. "But I don't think everyone would be so subdued if they just heard Horus was dead."
"True, very true," said Celine. "My bet, Horus's ships are here, in the system."
"I'd not bet against that," said Ketai. "If these stories are right, that there was void war in the last few months, testing the defenses, the main attack had to be coming."
He trailed away as they heard footsteps above. Lots of them. They watched the officers coming down again. Few of them went up.
"Where are the others?"
Zenobi asked, when the last of the officers from the lowest deck had gone. Those that were now coming down wore the badges of Beta Company, quartered in the deck directly below.
20 went up. Only 15 came down.
Special duties? Suggested Member, even though she didn't look convinced by his answer. Those officers that were returning were tight-lipped, glancing at each other with pointed expressions, whose meaning was lost on the watching troopers.
Do they look worried? Said Ketai.
They don't look worried, said Zenobi. Not scared for themselves, worried. More like guilty.
She stopped as Captain Egwu descended the rungs of the ladder at the centre of the carriage. Okoye followed, as did most of the others from the company.
Three, whispered Celine. Who's missing?
Kubadimosi Odioyo Onobanjo, said Ketai quickly. All lieutenants.
Odioyo was a platoon commander, said Zenobi. What does it mean?
We're about to find out, said Menba,
directing their attention back to the newly returned officers. Captain Egwu stood in the middle of the deck, while most of the lieutenants made their way back to their respective platoons and squads. Okoye stopped a short distance away, eyes flicking from one subordinate to the next, agitated.
Eyes and ears on the captain,
he said quietly, turning on his heel to face their company commander. Egwu stood with her hands behind her back, pacing a slow circle to look at the whole deck. She kept glancing at the ladder to the top deck and the hatchway to which it ascended. It was impossible not to be drawn to the object of her attention, so that Zenobi found herself staring at the iron rungs with growing unease, transmitted from the captain, though Egwu said nothing and kept any telltale expression from her face. A succession of sharp reports, followed by loud thumps on the deck above, caused Zenobi to flinch, not alone amongst the gathered troopers. Around her, troopers were looking up, murmurs of disquiet rippling around the room. There was no mistaking the noise, even muffled by the deck. Gunshots. Zenobi's first reaction was to turn wide-eyed and look for Menba. He glanced at her, shook his head a fraction, and returned his gaze to the ladder. Booted feet appeared a few seconds later, soon revealed to be those of an integrity enforcer. A score of them descended, followed by Jawahir and her cohort of officers. Six assigned to the company remained, and the rest descended with enforcer escort to the decks below. The Integrity High officer gave a nod to Egwu, who cleared her throat before addressing the company.
The forces of War Master Horus have reached the solar system. Naval and Legion fleets are engaged in void warfare against these flotillas at the gates near Pluto and Neptune.
The captain paced as she continued.
We have no further intelligence regarding the ongoing status of that battle, and we do not plan to provide a running commentary. We will try to keep you informed of any major strategic developments, but the assumption from this moment forward is that Horus will, sooner or later, reach orbit over Terra and commence invasion.
Whether it was discipline or shock that held their tongues, the troopers of the Defence Corps greeted this news in stoic silence. Though Zenobi had agreed with Celine's prediction, and had been expecting something like this to be announced, to hear the actual words set her heart racing. For a great part of her life, she had been prepared for the coming battles, and to think that they were weeks, possibly even days, from combat was exciting and terrifying. Mostly terrifying, the more she considered it, but it was tempered by the knot of duty she felt hard in her gut. She was no warrior born, not a legionary or even a proper soldier of the Imperial Army. But when the recruiters had come and spoken to her and the rest of her family, they had all been in agreement. For Adaba, for future generations, they had to fight and give their lives if needed. She remembered not quite understanding what was happening, but feeling her mother's grip on her shoulder, reassuring and proud. And every day since then, whether on the line or with the company, she had turned her thoughts to the time when the promise would become reality. She was brought back to the present by the raised voice of Jawahir.
The War Master's forces are closing upon Terra.
Her words were calm and assured, bearing no threatening undertone as they had on her first introduction. She might as easily have been telling them the latrine rotor had been changed.
Nothing but the utmost dedication to the task ahead will be tolerated. We have completed our inspection of your officers in light of this news. Those that fell short of our expectations have been executed.
Again, there was little reaction from the Adaba troopers. The noises they had heard had left little doubt as to the missing officers' fate. There were, however, voices of consternation rising up from the lower decks. Zenobi realized that they could not have been forewarned, and were hearing this news first from the mouths of their integrity officers.
"Such action may seem harsh, and in a time of peace you would be correct," Jawahir continued.
She turned her gaze as she spoke, addressing them all, her eyes seeming to fall upon everyone present for a second each. Not long enough to register a reaction, but a feeling of constant scrutiny all the same.
"The decision was not made lightly nor arbitrarily. Do not grieve for them. Had they been left in their positions, their lack of commitment would have eroded your own and jeopardized the integrity and courage of this fighting force. Just as we will not allow any of you to waver from the course that must be followed, so we hold those that lead you to the highest standards. Hesitation in the face of the enemy will cost lives. Doubts that we serve a cause greater than ourselves will undermine discipline."
Her expression softened, becoming almost matriarchal as she pivoted slowly once more.
"We do not wish to terrify you into obedience. It is natural that you look upon the decisions you have made and wonder if you have done the right thing. Such lapses are understandable, but they have no place in battle. You must act without thought, without question, without regret. To do otherwise is to risk the victory towards which we all strive, for which we should all be prepared to give our lives."
Silence followed, broken only by the background clatter of wheels on rails and the hum of energy cables. Zenobi felt herself swaying, thinking at the motion of the carriage at first, but increasingly so as a sense of unreality descended on her. She was reminded of the time she had been told of the War Master, and what had occurred during the Great Crusade, of being subjected to ideas so much larger than she was that it was almost overwhelming to think about them. A hand on her elbow steadied her.
"Breathe, cousin," Menba told her with a concerned look. "Breathe."
"I will be working with the integrity officers to select suitable replacements for those..."
Egwu paused, glanced at Jawahir, and then continued.
"Gaps in the command structure will be filled from the ranks, just like on the factory line. That is all."
Zenobi sagged, realizing that she had been holding herself as taut as a wire for several minutes. The babble that erupted across the deck was immediate, divided between the two topics of conversation, Horus's imminent arrival and the executions. Before she could say anything, Zenobi felt a tap on her shoulder, and turned to find Sergeant Alexander looking at her. He took a step back and tilted his head towards the integrity officers. Zenobi looked past him, her gaze meeting the stare of Jawahir.
"Interview time, Zenobi," said Alexander. "You're up next."
Chapter 8 Charge of the Berserker. Loyalty scrutinized. The Telethesic Ward. Lionsgate Spaceport, surface approach, Highway 2, assault hour. The barrage of the Iron Warriors lit the peak of the Lionsgate like a candle. Red flames crawled across its HAB units and docks, long licks of scarlet that danced with a strange life. In the southeast, on the far side of the artificial mountain, purple flames silhouetted high shipyards and kilometre-long boarding quays, the twin beacon to Fulgrim and his Emperor's children.
That's the signal!
Barked Khan, slamming his fist onto the roof of the Land Raider to alert the driver. All around him others were responding in similar kind, raising war shouts and cries to Khorne that rolled down the highway along with the sudden growl of engines coming to life. It had taken all of Khan's willpower to linger with his brothers, fighting back the urge to charge headlong at the enemy. To do so, would have meant throwing themselves into the teeth of the defence without any support from Perturabo's legion. He lifted Gorechild in his other hand as the engines of 500 transports and tanks grew to a roar, their tracks snarling over pitted ferrocrete. Rhinos, land raiders, and Spartan transports, flanked by an echelon of predators and vindicators. This support element was much diminished, for many of Khan's brothers were incapable of controlling themselves sufficiently to steer or guide a heavy gun. Slaves were chained into their positions, or servitors installed to take the place of the truly living. Freed from other concerns, the legionaries would be able to storm forth and slaughter without distraction once they reached their target. Khan was thrown back in the cupola as the driver rammed the assault transport forward, the land raider heeling and swaying as it picked up speed, thundering across ground cratered by thousands of shellbursts. Around him others vied to take the lead, their shouted urging crackling across the vox, mixed with boasts of the souls they would send to Khorne's realm that day. The roar and smoke of the assault column surrounded Khan, a battle din that started his heart thumping their own percussion, the implant in his skull adding an insistent, rapid pulse to the symphony. But it was inside that the music swelled. He felt the blood god reaching into him, lighting a fire in his gut to ignite a rage that no mortal shell could contain. He revved Gorechild, delighting in the glitter of the signal flame on the whir of the mica dragon teeth that served as its blade. He let out a roar that became a howl, and then from deep within he gave voice to the commands of Khorne, slamming his fist upon the armor plate in time with his chant, "Kill! Maim! Burn!" Arabindian Massif, 97 days before assault. The thrill of finally being allowed to tread upon the hallowed upper deck momentarily quelled the sickness roiling through Zenobi's gut. She held her breath as her eyeline cleared the hatch, and she was granted her first proper look at the domain of the officers. It was disappointing. Bare metal bulkheads created a small square space directly around the ladder. A bench was bolted to the wall, and though it was currently unoccupied, the scuffing in front of it was evidence of the centuries that had been using it. Beside it, a few steps led up to an armoured hatch with a small round window, though all she could see beyond was a sky smeared with dark clouds, underlit by the early morning sun. To the left and right stretched narrow corridors, lined with more doors, leading to another ladder landing about 10 meters away, and so on and on for the length of the carriage. She turned about, away from the bench, to find another corridor, broader than the others, that ran across the width of the train. There were ladder rungs cut into the wall here, leading up to roof entrances, armoured like the other gun turrets. A few metres away, a dynastic enforcer waited, maul held across the front of her thighs in both hands, feet shoulder-width apart in regulation pose. "This way," she told Zenobi, stepping to one side and pointing to an open door a few metres further along the passageway. The sound of footsteps on the rungs behind her prompted Zenobi to move, aware that Jawahir was following. She hurried past the enforcer and into the waiting chamber. Inside was more metal, and at first she took it to be a cell. There were holes in the walls where shelf brackets had been bolted, revealing the chamber's original purpose as a storeroom. In place of whatever crates and sacks it had contained, it now played host to a small metal table and two chairs set opposite each other. There was a triangular banner hanging on the wall, real cloth from a pole of real wood. The design incorporated the six symbols of the dynastic chiefs, gold against a red background, the whole trimmed with coiled purple thread.
"One of the old standards, from unification."
Zenobi turned to find Jawahir at the doorway. The Integrity High Officer glanced at the chair with its back to them, and Zenobi moved next to it immediately.
"A reminder to us that Hive Adaba has a history with the Emperor that stretches back generations."
Zenobi opened her mouth to reply, but was silenced by a raised hand. Jawahir stepped into the interview cell and closed the door behind her. She placed a hand on Zenobia's shoulder as she walked past, firmly pushing her into the metal chair, before taking the seat opposite. She knitted her fingers together on the table, and Zenobia noticed the bright scarlet of her fingernails. Implants, she guessed, not painted. Like the tattoos, they were permanent modifications to declare her position and allegiance.
"You are Zenobia Adedeji, lineworker and now trooper. Captain Egu vouches for you, and has even entrusted the company banner to your care. That is quite remarkable. A serious responsibility for a 17-year-old."
Zenobia kept her nerve and her silence. There had been no question asked, and it seemed unwise to volunteer information.
"I think she is right."
Jawahir leaned back, and her hands moved to her lap.
"I'm sure you know all about the history of the Adedeji. I share the name of a Ruby dynasty. Their blood is in me, even if my family have fallen low in status in recent decades." "Former Ruby dynasty. Shamed by the Emperor for resisting unification."
Zenobia fought the temptation to defend the honor of her ancestors. Many a squabble and a few outright brawls had proven that whatever the facts, the accepted story of the Adedeji was that they had betrayed the Emperor.
"The Adedeji are no longer among the Gifted Six. I'm a line worker. I don't know much about the Top Hive politics or what happened to my distant relatives." "And you are loyal to Adaba?"
Zenobia nodded. There seemed nothing further to add to the assertion. A ghost of a smile passed across Jawahir's lips.
"Do I frighten you?"
The truth, Zenobia remembered. Everyone that had come out of the interviews had a single message to pass on. Just tell the truth.
"I find you and your officers intimidating," she said. "I know that my loyalty to the cause is as strong as the foundations of Adaba. Even so, I worry that you might not see that."
Jawahir pursed her lips, eyes never straying from Zenobia's. The trooper met her stare for as long as she could, out of pride more than defiance, but eventually her gaze dropped to her hands. She was gripping the edge of the table tight and hadn't realized it.
"You've not said a single word to convince me of your dedication," said Jawahir. "You're very calm."
This time Zenobia could not hold back the urge to speak.
"I haven't anything to fear, if what you say is true. I am loyal. I swore the oaths. Overseer Captain Egu herself recruited me and my family. If I did not trust you, I'd still trust her. And since she came back down after... since she is still commander of the company, I guess that you must trust her too." "Do you find that logic reassuring?"
Still, Jawahir's eyes bored into Zenobia. She wasn't sure if the integrity high officer had even blinked.
"Is that how you see the world? A place of reasons and rules?" "I lived on the factory line, Bana Madam," Zenobia said. "Everything works a certain way, or it doesn't work at all. People die if it goes wrong."
Jawahir smiled again, though now the expression was dry, devoid of any humor.
"I meant no offense,"
Zenobia added quickly.
"People die in battle, too, if people do not follow the system." "You are a follower, aren't you, Trooper Adedeji?" "I will obey the orders of my officers, Bana Madam,"
Zenobia assured her interrogator.
"I would never bring disgrace to the name of Adedeji." "No, I'm sure you wouldn't. That you have retained the name, when most of your distant relations threw it away like an old jerkin, tells me it means a lot to you."
Zenobia had to clamp her teeth shut to stop the words that wanted to burst from her. For more than a week she had hardened herself to the idea of being shouted at, accused, insulted, and threatened. But she hadn't expected this nagging, baiting line of conversation. It was like her grandmother's silent stare when they'd been assembled as youngsters to uncover the perpetrators of some infantile misdemeanour. The guilty were always the first to spring to their own defence. It wasn't until she was 14 that Zenobi had realised this. Unfortunately, too late to make use of it, her grandmother having been passed to the Endforges 2 years earlier.
"What are you thinking about?"
Jawahir sat forward again, clasped hands back on the tabletop.
"Answer me now!"
"Abbe Susu,"
Zenobi replied without thought. She flushed, embarrassed at the childish nickname.
"My father's mother. She was the lawkeeper in the family when I was little. I am older than your grandmother was, Zenobi. Can you believe that?"
"No, Bana Madame. Your skin, your hair. Maybe for top hivers. No work smog in your lungs. No forge heat on your skin."
Zenobi frowned, her eyes flicking to the tattoos and fingernails.
"Maybe the dynastic chiefs give you a pick-me-up, right? I heard that top-hivers can live 70, 80 years or more." "That is right, and also wrong. I am a little over 90 years old. I will live a few more years, but I cannot have another treatment. This journey, this battle that we travel to, will be my last effort for the dynastic chiefs. No end fires for me, I expect. Nor you, Zenobi. How does that make you feel, to know that your body will likely end up on a pile, rotting under the sun in some place you have never heard of?"
"I'll be dead. I'll not care either way. What matters is how I die."
"And how will that be?" "Fighting for freedom and the lives of my companions, Bana Madame."
Zenobi stood up, feeling a wave of assertion pushing her to her feet. Her knees wobbled slightly, but she held her place, and a look with the Integrity High Officer.
"If my words don't convince you, then I hope I live long enough that my actions do. If you doubt me, then pull your gun and shoot me like those officers."
"Really?"
Jawahir stood and flipped the top of her holster. She slid out a long-barreled auto-pistol, the crest of the Aleda dynasty engraved into a plate on its side. The muzzle swung towards Zenobi, the small black hole swallowing all of her attention.
"Is this how you would die for Adaba?"
Zenobi tried to speak, cowed by the muzzle, regretting her rashness and the hint of pride that had led her to dare the anger of this woman. It had been a foolish, selfish act, insolent. She closed her eyes and bowed her head, accepting her punishment.
"If I have done wrong, chastise me, Bana Madame. But ask yourself a question first."
Zenobi straightened and looked the officer in the eye again.
"Would you rather not have one more bullet for your real enemies?"
Lionsgate Spaceport, surface approach, Highway 2, assault hour. Ahead of the assault, thousands of slave beasts and the serfs of the Iron Warriors continued to throw themselves at the defensive line that had been drawn across the highway leading into the southeastern gate of the spaceport. Gun towers and pillboxes spewed fire into the numberless mass, prevented from targeting the incoming transports by blocked lines of fire and the fear of being overrun by the much closer foe. Gun captains further up the Lionsgate port's flanks had no such concerns, and it was not long before shells began to fall among the blur of red transports, carving furrows through the ash, dust and smoke that blanketed the katabatic plains. The tanks leading the charge opened fire, their accuracy severely diminished by the rate of advance and inexperience of their crews. Even so, a welter of siege cannon shells, lasblasts and plasma punched through with a swirl of smog and debris, flaring against the local power fields and smashing into ferrocrete walls. The support echelon slewed aside, guns still firing, allowing the transports to race past, their own weapons flaring and roaring.
"Into the heart of battle,"
snarled Khan.
"Drive your blades down their throats!"
The road was littered with the corpses of earlier attacks, crushed beneath the tracks of the Land Raider, sending splashes of blood up its blue and white flanks. Khan's enhanced sense of smell was awash with the scents of death and battle. His eyes rolled back in his head as he took a deep draught, intoxicated by the thought of imminent bloodshed. The Land Raider slowed, and Khan forced himself to focus. Ahead, a throng of turncoat soldiers and legion slaves pressed along the highway, blocking the way.
"Drive on!"
he yelled down through the hatch.
"I'll go through!"
The driver laughed and accelerated again, bringing the Land Raider back up to full combat speed. Some of those unfortunates at the back of the crowd heard the approach of engines above the din of the barrage and turned in time to flee. Others did not, and were slammed aside or crushed under the tracks, or pinned upon the razor-sharp blades that had been affixed to the front of the tank. Their screams bypassed Khan's ears and flared through his brain like bolts of electricity, causing him to howl again. Drool fell from teeth bared inside his helm as animal hunting urges overwhelmed any higher human sense. Like a blade parting flesh, the assault column carved through the press of lesser warriors, coating the highway with a slick of pulverized organs and bone. The spray from the tracks coated the following vehicles in gore. The warriors within wrestled with each other to push themselves to the open hatches so that they might be anointed in blood for their new god, armor already much crimson-stained, getting fresh slicks of life fluid. Several vehicles slewed aside, falling by the wayside as their running gear became clogged with viscera. Their passengers poured out of the assault ramps and through roof hatches, leaping down onto the road to continue the assault on foot. As though a curtain peeled back, the throng of serfs and soldiers parted, and Khan heard a great rumbling over and above that of the flying column and the big guns of the Iron Warriors. Detonations blossomed amongst the lead wave, incendiary shells and airbursts scything down hundreds of mortal troopers and mutants pressed into the breach. Beyond them loomed towering armoured vehicles clad in the ochre yellow of Dawn's Legion. Mighty Leviathans and Capitol Imperialis, three of each, emerged from the vast gateway, guns laying down a carpet of fire that ripped whole companies to bloody shreds in seconds. With them came other super-heavy vehicles, Baneblades, Shadow Swords, and other variants in colours of the Imperial Army, and 7th Legion Malkador heavy tanks with plasma cannons and rapid-firing laser blasters. The first wave slowed, balked by this sudden wall of armoured might and the beams of deadly energy that lanced from their batteries. Some of the rearmost Horde regiments turned to flee the counterattack, only to find themselves in the path of the onrushing Chosen of Khorne. Guns roared retribution for their cowardice, cutting them down even as they fell beneath the armoured vehicles. Even through the frothing madness of his butcher's nails and the spirit of Khorne rushing through his body, Khan vaguely recognised the danger. He tried to order the column to slow, so that guns might be brought to bear. The words would not come. He thought to signal the Iron Warriors to redirect their strikes or bring in attack runs from gunships that circled overhead, but all he could manage was an animal panting. So it was that instead of fear, he embraced the nature of his master, and admitted in that moment what he had known in his soul for many years. He would die in battle, broken and bloodied, but his spirit not quenched. Now he gave his death to a cause far worthier than the Emperor, for his blood would spill for the god of battle, and one day his skull would be raised up and placed in honour on the throne of Khorne. But it would not be this day. The beacon barrage had called not only to the legionaries of the World Eaters. Khan felt a shimmer of anticipation run through him, and looked up as he heard an unearthly bellow cutting through the tumult of war. Against the lightning-wreathed clouds that crowded above the palace, a silhouette of a great winged beast appeared. It dived down, trailing godfire and shadow, the gleam of its magic blade like a thunderbolt in the darkness. Angron, demon primarch of the World Eaters, did not slow to land, but speared into the nearest of the Capitol Imperialis. Shields flared and failed, engulfing the titanic engine in brief layers of gold and purple. The tip of the sword sheared through armour like that of a castle's bastion, and a shower of molten plasteel and shards of ceramite fountained from the gaping wound. Though the vehicle was the size of a hablock, Angron's impact was enough to rock it on its huge tracks. With a sound of tortured metal, it fell sideways as the Primarch beat his wings and howled his anger. Khan's last sight of his lord was amid sparks and flames, as Angron leapt into the exposed innards of the fallen war machine. He grinned as he imagined the carnage being wrought within, the slaughter of a company of soldiers in tight confines, the walls and floor and ceiling decorated with their blood and body parts, their skulls offered up in praise of the blood god. The remains of the super-heavy command vehicle exploded, engulfed by a plasma fireball 200 meters across, overloading the shields of its neighbour and incinerating several smaller tanks in the gap between the behemoths. Khan recovered his sight from the blinding flash to see Angron striding from the molten ruin, pieces of burning wreckage jutting from his armour and unnatural flesh, trailing black flames. A leviathan turned its main cannon upon the Primarch, belching forth a shell that could break open battle titans. Angron cleaved the air with his curse-edged blade, cutting the shell in flight so that its detonation rolled harmlessly around him. The mobile command bastion blazed away with full batteries, slamming shell after shell and laser volleys into the unfeeling form of Angron. There was nothing that could stop him. A blood miasma surrounded the Primarch, warding away attacks like a power field, drawing energy from the continuing slaughter. The counterattack faltered in the face of the unstoppable beast, and the super-heavy tanks withdrew, leaving a Capitol Imperialis as rearguard. Platoons of soldiers alighted from its ramps, not to challenge the Primarch, but to flee for the safety of the spaceport. Angron bellowed after them, thwarted in his pursuit by a fresh cannonade from a slab-sided leviathan. The column had almost drawn level with their lord, their sponson weapons and pintle mounts chasing the fleeing troopers into the shadow of the Lionsgate spaceport. Khan dragged himself from the cupola and leapt to the ground as the Land Raiders slid to a halt, surrounded by a surge of power-armoured berserkers chanting for blood and calling upon Khorne for battle favours. The Primarch hacked apart the Imperial command vehicle as Khan and the assault column neared. Angron broke open the ammunition stores, and the shells within detonated, surrounding his immortal form like celebration fireworks. Blade aloft, his sons a red tide around him, the demon Primarch led the advance. Ahead, the great gates started to close. Angron snarled and leapt to the wing, soaring past the ruin of the Capitol Imperialis, becoming a scarlet blur as he gained speed. He was perhaps 300 meters from the still-open gate, when a flare of silver light pulsed around him, hurling him from the sky. The Primarch crashed, breaking stone, furled wings trailing silvery sparks, eyes aflame with pale light. Roaring defiance, he came to his feet and launched himself again at the fortifications, but was repulsed a second time, the silver energy coiling about his limbs like chains as he tumbled to the ground once more. On foot he approached, sword and fist pounding at the insubstantial barrier, but every blow was reflected back at him, so that he recoiled from his own fury, armour rent in a dozen places, as though his mystic blade had carved it open. Khan's vigour left him as he witnessed the impotency of his lord, flailing mindlessly at the psychic barrier that kept his demon form at bay. The defence guns that had fallen silent during the counterattack came to destructive voice again. Transports exploded under the renewed barrage, and legionaries died by the hundred, forced to take shelter in the defences they had overrun, while still laden transports drew back, seeking sanctuary. Angron lifted away, thwarted by the shield, and soared north. Lightning crackled from his wingtips as he tested the extent of the barrier. He disappeared with altitude, and then returned, before winging southwards, seeking easier prey. Clarity burned through Khan's battle rage. His world-eaters would be trapped against the closed gate, super-heavy tanks ready to strike from within, guns pounding them from above. Without their Khorne-blessed Primarch, the Legion would break uselessly upon the spaceport's walls. To die in close battle, eye to eye with the foe, was one fate. But he would not let Khorne's favoured be blasted apart from afar, raging at an enemy out of reach. Reluctantly, sickened by the notion, as his butcher's nails threaded chastising agony through his brain, Khan voxed the order to withdraw. Lionsgate Spaceport, surface approach, Highway 3, assault hour. Heaving up a bucket of water, Aggerson doused the breech of the gun again, steam filling the ferrocrete bunker as it hissed from the overheated cannon.
"Give it 2 minutes," said Alexa, the gun captain.
She pulled a low stick from her pocket and lit it. Aggerson frowned and looked at the three shells lined up next to the ammunition elevator from the magazine below. Alexa shrugged.
"What? There's a full-scale attack. Nobody's doing gun inspections."
Aggerson didn't bother arguing, but exchanged a glance with Maxis, the third and final member of their gun crew. He came to an unspoken agreement with her, and they both moved to the slit in the wall that served as their only window. Battery 65B was situated overlooking Highway 3, which ran north from the Lionsgate spaceport. The other four guns of the battery still fired, sending their shells down into the swathe of purple armoured figures a kilometre below. Around them, larger guns thundered their deadly payloads even further along the road, targeting the command vehicles and super-heavies that had moved up in support of the Emperor's Children attack. Smaller anti-personnel weapons rattled and barked from emplacements in the lower levels, though much was wreathed in smoke and choked with rubble from the enemy's attacks. Distance gave the scene an unreal quality. Target coordinates would come through on the command feed, and they fired at that spot, never really seeing what they were aiming at. Even with the naked eye, the procession of traitor space marines and swarms of lesser warriors seemed like something from a vid projection. Aggerson saw a swathe of purples and gold, swirled about with multicoloured fog that reminded him more of his mother's incense burners than the smog of battle. Pennants and banners flew from vehicles and company standards, their aquilas and honours replaced with stylized runes that he had never seen before, but which made him feel queasy to look at all the same. Vehicles were festooned with new decoration, like Baroque railing spikes with body parts impaled upon them. And among the din of engines and crash of weapons, he thought he heard music. Disharmonies of strident orchestral works, alongside nerve-shredding electronic screeches and inhuman wailing.
"They're pulling back,"
gasped Maxis, pointing out of the slit. Aggerson realized it was true. Under cover of a renewed bombardment, squads of the Emperor's Children were moving away from the spaceport, while squads of power-armored warriors pulled back from the breaches in the lowest batteries. They filed onto their transports, kaleidoscopic smoke belching from engines as the troop carriers picked up speed heading northwards. Others followed on foot, covered by fire from squads positioned along the sides of the highway.
"And don't come back!"
Maxis laughed, shaking a fist. Aggerson didn't share her good humour. Something was off.
"Cap, pass me the Magnox,"
he said, stepping back from the slit to hold a hand out to Alexa.
"They're mine,"
she said.
"Please." "Oh, fine."
Alexa tossed him the spotter's Magnox, which he only just caught. Turning back to the slit, he leaned out as far as he dared, Magnox raised to his eyes. Autofocus lenses clicked until he sighted on the ground below. He swept towards the main highway and saw hundreds of purple-armored space marines marching back to the road. They were not alone. Each carried or dragged two or three prisoners, some unconscious, others flailing futilely at their superhuman captors. Rhinos, land raiders, and other tanks crawled out of range of the guns, captives piled in their roofs and strapped to their flanks like bundles of baggage. Most wore Imperial Army uniforms, seized from the lower batteries and the regiments that had been defending the highway approaches.
"They're taking people," he whispered.
Scanning along the road, he saw hundreds, maybe thousands, being hauled back to the waiting transports. He pulled himself back in and looked at his companions, mouth dry with fear.
"Why are they taking people?"
Chapter 9. A war song. Fresh assault. Flawed iron. Karachi Flats, 70 days before assault.
2 minutes!
The call went around, stilling all sound and motion as it moved from one part of the carriage to the next, hopping from squad to platoon to the whole company like an auditory epidemic. 2 minutes. 2 minutes was the call on the line to prepare for the shift change. 2 minutes to set the safeties on the machinery. 2 minutes to rack the tools. 2 minutes to clear the pipes, secure the cables, stow the lock bolts, and perform the hundreds of other small but essential duties that led to a smooth and safe handover. Zenobi looked around, chest swelling with suppressed emotion, as she saw the company coming to a halt as one. Across the divide she caught the eye of Sweetana, waiting with a few others by the stairwell.
"I've been working the line, working the line, working it all day,"
Zenobi began, her voice wavering a little.
"Just like my father before,"
Sweetana sang back in reply, joined by more voices from the company.
"I've been working the line, working the line, working it all night,"
Zenobi continued, growing in confidence. She could see Lieutenant Okoye hiding a smile behind his hand, other officers showing a mixture of amusement, pride, or contempt. The enforcers stopped their prowling as the chorus grew, swelling to fill the carriage with voices. An even louder, defiant burst of song erupted from the deck below, pulsing through the stairwells like a physical thing.
"All my days, working in the dark! All my days, carrying my own light!"
Zenobi remembered that second company came from the lowest part of the Cradle Spur, mostly Hive Corps miners that clawed raw materials back from the city's ancient substrate.
"I've been working the line, working the line, working all shift,"
she cried, her voice almost cracking with effort as she competed with the song from below, the two forming a harmony. The muted words of a third from the lowest deck drifted in and out of rhythm. All three songs rose and fell in competition. Zenobi almost choked, her throat tightening with emotion, stalling her words. It didn't matter. The carriage was almost rocking from the combined voices of all three decks, which segued together into the unofficial anthem of Adaba. "Onwards, lords and ladies of industry." She heard the first faltering notes disturbing the song a few moments before movement drew her eyes to the ladders from the upper deck. The singing fractured as one after another the troopers caught sight of Integrity High Officer Jawahir. Disconcerted by the disharmony creeping in from the upper deck, perhaps wondering what was amiss, the companies below stuttered and quietened in the following minute. Other Integrity officers filed past their leader, heading to the lower decks, silencing the last voices raised in song.
"You need not silence yourselves on my account," said Jawahir,
her voice raised to carry across the hall-sized compartment.
"But perhaps it is time to stop singing about the past. You are not on the line any longer. Now, perhaps, turn hearts and tongues to the future. A new song for Adaba. A war song."
This declaration was met with speculative muttering, soon silenced by whispered threats from the lieutenants and sergeants.
"It is time,"
the chief of the Integrity officers declared, rubbing her hands together with relish. Quite what she was so animated about, Zenobi didn't know. As the order was passed round to prepare for disembarkation, she remembered a piece of advice from Menba and tried not to think about it too much. Katabatic Plains, 4 hours since assault. Forex found himself viewing the continuing attack from the roof of a burnt-out way station, about 7 kilometres from the Lionsgate spaceport. The highway that ran alongside had been churned to ferrocrete grit by the passage of so many tanks and mobile fortresses. The 4th Legion had created circumvallation works in a 20-kilometre arc around their objective, formed of armoured vehicles and self-creating fortifications, based on ancient, standard template construct systems. The Khan had led his white scars against the engines of the new Machina and Mortarian's warped legionaries, and caused great damage and delays, and the surprise sally by the Imperial fists against the opening assault had caused Kroger to reflect a little on his impatience. If Dorne or any of his allies thought to launch another counterattack against Perturabo's legion, they would find far stiffer opposition. Thoughts of what had happened to the Death Guard gave Forex pause. There had been no formal report about their delayed arrival, but it was clear their transit through the warp had met with complications. Those he had once known as Dusk Raiders were no more. Their Primarch had become an embodiment of nightmare, like Angron and Fulgrim, and their bodies had been changed by exposure to something beyond Forex's knowledge. He was not naive about the forces to which the War Master had pledged himself, but he was no expert either. He had seen demon-altered word-bearers and mutated sorcerers, as well as the results of the new Machina's experiments with previously forbidden warp tech. Watching the sea of once-human and pseudo-human creatures hurling itself at the outer defences left a sour taste in his mouth. The thought that the Iron Warriors might one day succumb to that kind of degradation made him feel sick. He turned to his companion, Sultan Vul Bron, who was known as the Stonewart. Overall commander of the barrage, he was observing the effectiveness of his cannons and rockets. A cluster of cataphracti terminators loitered behind him, their presence more a badge of the Stonewart's rank than a military precaution.
"I'm glad at least one true Iron Warrior stands alongside me still," said Forex. "What do you mean?"
The Stonewart did not turn his head, gaze fixed upon the conflagration engulfing the Lionsgate spaceport.
"I'd have you in the Trident, you know. You have a talent for destruction." "I am content with my allotted role," Sultan Vul Bron replied. "The Trident is not missing a member. It will be an outrageous stretch of fortune if all three of us survive this battle, you know that. I would rather have someone steadier at my shoulder."
Now the Stonewrought turned, his burnished helm catching the light of a thousand fires, sparkling as volcano cannons spat back their fury in counter-battery fire against his siege machines.
"You assume that you will survive, while the others might fall. That borders on a threat. None was intended, to you or them."
Forex stepped closer, dropping his voice.
"However, the loss of one or both of my fellow Triarchs would cause me no grief. Personally, and as a commander of the Fourth, I have grave reservations."
"Both have the favour of Perturabo."
The Stonewrought paused, as hundreds of rockets flared overhead, lighting the sky as if it were a celebration day. His head turned as he followed their progress, and gave a nod of satisfaction as they dipped and fell onto the lower levels of the port, not far from the foremost lines of attacking infantry. He returned his attention to Forex.
"To speak against them is to speak against the Primarch. Favour is fleeting. You know that as well as I do. Just ask Barossus. Kroger is fast becoming unstable. I saw him with the World Eaters, and even in a span of hours he has become even more irrational, as though tainted by their bloodlust. It is no secret that you desired Toramino to replace Harkon, but Kroger was raised in his place. Your disdain for Falk I find more surprising. His recommendation spilled easily from your lips when Harkon was dishonored, but now you speak against him. That was the barbarian Falk we knew."
Forex stepped aside the Stonewrought and gripped the remains of the wall that edged the flat rooftop. Ferrocrete crumbled beneath his fingers, weakened by anti-fortification viruses that had been released into the air by the new Machina.
"The thing that insists on being called the Warsmith is not the same, Barban Falk." "And you have a common complaint against both of your companions?" "Their loyalty is questionable," said Forex. "I sense that Kroger has set foot on the road that leads into the same mania as our allies in the World Eaters. The whisper of a bloody power now speaks in his ear. As for the allegiance of the Warsmith, I do not believe it is for mortal concerns any longer. This malaise, this power that grips our once proud cousins and strips away all honor and humanity, it comes from the War Master himself and hungers for us all. We have already turned traitor on the Emperor. Would you have us turn once more on the War Master? Or even against our Gene Father? No.
The thought that such an accusation might reach the ears of Perturabo made Forex shudder. The Primarch's hands were bloodied already by subordinates that had wronged him, for crimes both real and imaginary, and Forex had no desire to dare such wrath.
That is not what I said. But Horus is not our Gene Father, and he is using us, just as the others have used the Fourth since we left Terra. I wish for no part in your conspiracies, Forex.
The Stonewrought gestured towards the Lionsgate spaceport.
I have a task at hand, and it is all the occupation I need. Since the battle with the Eldar, since we saw what became of Fulgrim and his sons, I prefer to focus on immediate physical problems these days. I have no desire to venture into the less tangible realm. And that is what your plotting would entail. I cannot force you to share my doubts, but I would give further warning. These powers at play are courted by some of our brothers, knowingly or not. They desire us, and ignoring them will not rid us of their threat. When we are done with the Emperor's lackeys, there will be reckonings within the Legion.
I hear nothing,
said the Stonewrought, and turned away. Chapter 10 The Lord of Iron balked. A sorcerer's aid. Piercing the star spear. The vengeful spirit, Terran near orbit, 10 hours since assault. Abaddon despised Horus's court chamber aboard the vengeful spirit. Each time he returned, it seemed more a mockery of what it had once been, what it had once meant to him. His master spent ever more time behind the portal of the Empyrean, supposedly to do psychic battle with the Emperor himself, though Abaddon wondered if there might be darker reasons why the War Master retreated so regularly to his unreal sanctuary. Word had reached the vengeful spirit of the failure of Angron and Fulgrim to enter the Lionsgate spaceport. Like the palace proper, it was under the Emperor's protection. No being of demonic origin could cross the threshold. Was there a similar price for Horus to pay when he was not awash in the energies of the Empyrean? The leader of the Morneval was surprised to find himself the only member of that honoured group present, and dismayed to see that the Crimson Apostle shadowed him as usual. Zardu Leak and his silent blade slaves slipped through the shadows around the periphery, perhaps choosing to observe rather than intervene for a change. The word-bearer's sorcerer's mask eyes shone, 6 flashes of yellow in the gloom. Horus was present, his bald head sheened with thick sweat, his eyes sunken, ringed with darkness as one suffering heavy fatigue. Abaddon thought it impossible for a Primarch to show such weariness, much less his master, but Leak had told him of how the ruinous power's presence in his mortal form taxed the War Master's strength to its limits. Horus's expression was grim as he raised his gaze to meet the stare of Abaddon.
"The war progresses too slowly, Ezekiel," the War Master pronounced.
There was no accusation, simply a statement of fact. Horus gritted his teeth and sucked in a breath, odd lights dancing across his eyes for a few seconds. He blinked them away and seemed restored, his face not so lined as moments before, his shoulders straighter.
"I did not think Perturabo would fail you," said Abaddon. "If he cannot devise a means to enter the palace, I do not think his brothers will do so. Perhaps it is time that the greatest of our leaders takes his rightful place at the forefront of the battle." "You think I shirk my duties as general?"
Horus seemed amused by the idea.
"Not at all, War Master. I think your legions and countless other servants would fight harder to see you at their head.
Your vision has brought us to the door of the Emperor's throne room. But at the moment of your victory, you stand aside and let others break it down.
It cannot yet be done,
Horus said with a slow shake of the head, his expression turning somber.
Because of this psychic shield that bars the demons.
In part. But also, the powers that work through me gather yet more strength.
When I strike, I must annihilate my father entirely, body and soul, physically and psychically. Not a shred of him can survive, lest it grow again in some future century.
Gauntlet Claws tapped on the arm of the throne for several seconds.
Perturabo is the sanest of my brothers. His agenda is solely to serve me, to prove himself as strong as he believes he can be. You have already seen how the others work at cross purposes, except under firm hand. The Lord of Iron must be allowed his time of glory, or he will lose faith. And if I lose my reliable commander, what can I achieve with unreliable ones?
What is to be done?
We shall see.
Horus turned his head and nodded to one of the army of lesser creatures that attended the court. Incense billowed from burners, and the hololithic comms array flickered into life, bringing with it the images of the War Master's Primarch allies. Angron licked gore from a clawed hand, twitching with the taste of it, his bestial features broad and large in the column of light that projected from the ceiling. Fulgrim seemed to be lounging on a couch made of corpses, tail languidly flicking back and forth, while attended by creatures with eyes and mouths stitched shut, offering flagons and platters of treats to the Primarch. Mortarion seemed the most attentive, though his features were obscured by billows of vapour erupting from his mask with each stentorian breath. He was clad in darkness, and what Abaddon first took to be vox static soon resolved itself into the buzzing of thousands of flies. It was several more seconds before Perturabo answered the council. He paced, appearing and disappearing from view as he passed in and out of the comm capture unit aboard the Iron Blood. His fingers flexed murderously, and Abaddon caught glimpses of wreckage in the Primarch's hall. Of Magnus, there was no sign. Perturabo stopped his pacing and glared through the projection at his brothers.
The spaceport should be invested by now. We wasted many lives and much time in pointless attack when my cursed brothers cannot cross the boundary into the Emperor's domain.
Cursed,
drawled Fulgrim.
Says one that has not experienced the delights an immaterial existence has to offer.
Cursed,
Perturabo snapped.
You are less than I, for you cannot even set foot upon the palace grounds.
Then take Forgebreaker and knock upon the Emperor's doors yourself,
replied Mortarion, gaseous puffs accompanying his words.
I did not think the Lord of Iron was so cautious of spending his warriors' lives, said Abaddon. The Fourth rightly earned themselves a reputation for forcing battle, even in the face of costly resistance and tremendous casualties.
I would spend them for good cause, not dash them against the walls while my brothers amuse themselves with inhuman delights.
The image of Perturabo turned towards Horus and lowered to one knee.
I know that I promised you the walls, War Master, but I have not the tools to dismantle this shield. It not only spurns the presence of the Neverborn, I am sure it steals the hearts of the Emperor's servants. I could spend a century taking the spaceport apart, piece by piece, and yet my brothers would never lead their legions upon the ground hallowed by our father.
My faith in you is not misplaced, Perturabo, said Horus, standing up.
He gestured for the Lord of Iron to do likewise.
One setback is not defeat, as you know well. It was wrong of me to send you forth unarmed against the foe you would face.
Horus twisted, a clawed gauntlet stretching to point towards Laak.
In the absence of Magnus, who aids the soul battle in his own way, the greatest proponents of these arts are the word-bearers. I send to you my crimson apostle, the Oracle of the Neverborn.
"I am honored," said Leak, stooping from the shadows in a bow. "I have some theories regarding the telethesic ward of the Emperor. I shall summon the most powerful of our brethren, and, if the Lord Mortarion permits, discuss matters with Lord Typhus. Our efforts combined will find a means to break this shield."
"You will share all that your art can tell me," insisted Perturabo.
"If I am to deliver the palace to our War Master, I must have proper understanding of all the elements."
"Of course.
It will be necessary for me to be on Terra, if you are willing to hold counsel there with me."
"I will," agreed Perturabo. "And you will have Abaddon to accompany you," added Horus. "There are better aims to which I might be employed," argued the first captain. "The sons of Horus can draw defenders away from the Lion's Gates by presenting threat elsewhere." "You will go where I command," Horus said heavily, eyes flashing with anger. "Leak is to my soul as you are to my body. Where the one goes, so too does the other." Abaddon restrained any argument. He looked at Leak, but it was impossible to read any reaction from the Crimson Apostle's masked, inhuman face.
"By your will I am commanded," said Abaddon,
bowing his head to his Primarch.
"I will have Typhus ready for your instruction," said Mortarion.
His image wavered and then vanished.
"Then I will prepare for my descent," said Perturabo. "Transmit your coordinates, Leak, and the time of meeting."
The Lord of Iron's feed blinked out of existence. Fulgrim muttered a distracted farewell and faded also, leaving Angron's immense face floating in the midst of the chamber.
"Be ready, Angron, when Perturabo calls upon you," said Horus, returning to his throne.
He gestured, and the link was severed, plunging the chamber into gloom once more. Lionsgate Spaceport, Mesifex Core, 18 hours since assault. Manish Darbanjar did not like the quiet at all. For all of his 48 years he had lived and served the Emperor within the great tower of the Lionsgate Spaceport. Starspear by birth and hauler operator by labour, he rarely ventured below the 30-kilometer level. His world had always been one of clanking machinery, shouting overseers and the rumble of starship plasma engines. Now all he could hear was the distant tremor of the palace bombardment. The orbital attack had moved on from the spaceport. Through announcements and hall briefings, Colonel Maigrout had warned the people that this cessation of the artillery attack was likely a forewarning of a renewed assault. The upper gun batteries had fallen silent for the time being, denied targets for their wrath while the enemy regathered their strength.
"We've still got to be ready," he told his wife Daxa.
She nodded, fingering the autogun in her lap as she sat in a rocking chair made from spare hauler parts.
"We'll be ready, flower of my heart," she replied. "When the alarms sound, we'll wait in the hall with the others."
"When the alarms sound," said Manish.
He pushed himself out of his low chair, limbs stiff with arthritis, protesting at the sudden movement. Leaning his gun against the cupboard of their small kitchen unit, he picked up a pan and filled it from the water urn. The main supply had been cut off in case it was poisoned by the enemy. Plague was rampant in the main palace, but the spaceport had so far been isolated from the flux and poxes that were killing hundreds of thousands beyond the wall. The electric cook ring was also disconnected, but the Imperial Army had issued tens of thousands of camp stoves. One sat on the countertop, smelling faintly of refined alcohol fuel.
"Tea?"
He looked over his shoulder. Daxa was rubbing a smudge of gun lubricant from the cuff of her dress.
"What's this special occasion?"
she replied with a smile.
"We won't be getting any more for a while."
"Might as well drink it," he told her.
Just as he reached for the caddy, 15,000 kilometers away in low orbit, the Iron Warrior's cruiser, Rebuke, prepared to fire its main lance array, as did the 7 ships of its battle group, plus scores of others. Simultaneously, 100 gunships entered targeting range, loosing a storm of missiles and shells. The combined weight of this gunship fire overloaded a patch of the Starspear's protective fields, roughly 300 meters across.
Into this relative eye of the needle, the Rebuke and its fellow warships fired beams of energized particles, powerful enough to punch holes through starship armor and level ground fortifications. The upper atmosphere caused almost no diffraction at all, so that the combined beams hit the weakened patch of shielding at almost 100% strength. In microseconds, scores of laser blasts punched through the skin of the spaceport, sheared through 10 kilometers of bulkheads and supports, but avoided damaging the core shafts of the transport network. The first Manish and Daxa knew of the attack was when their bedroom vaporized, leaving a glowing hole in the wall between it and the living space. Decompression lifted them both from their feet, along with chairs, pots, burner, guns, and other detritus. Manish's scream ripped from his mouth as a wisp of vapor, a moment before his lungs emptied, their fabric disrupted by the sudden loss of pressure. The roar of winds disappeared as his eardrums burst. Manish spun through the air alongside his wife, moisture icing on his skin, the bodies of thousands of other workers flying alongside them, until the onrushing winds dragged them into the atmosphere, 40 kilometers above the ground. Despite the freezing cold, his body temperature was warm enough to boil his blood at that altitude, though thankfully he was unconscious from hypoxia before his eyes leaked blood and his tongue swelled up to choke him. He was already dead before he started falling, and the silhouettes of hundreds of gunships appeared against the rising dawn. Back in Starspear, alarms started to howl. Chapter 11. The Archmagos. Obliteration. A Concealed Blade. Lionsgate Spaceport, Mesofex Corps.